This is Audible.
Wizard, The Life and Times of Nikola Tesla, Biography of a Genius, by Mark J. Cipher. 16. Fire at the Lab, 1895. The destruction of Nikola Tesla's workshop with its wonderful contents is something more than a private calamity. It is a misfortune to the whole world. It is not any degree an exaggeration to say that the men living at this time who are more important to the human race than this young gentleman can be counted on the fingers of one hand, perhaps on the thumb of one hand. Charles Dana. It was one fine Sunday afternoon in 1894, as Tesla was strolling up Fifth Avenue with 25-year-old D. McFarlane Moore, a colleague of great promise in the field of fluorescent lighting, when the Serbian savant deliberately stopped and pensively proclaimed, "Moore, after we have signaled from any point to any point on the Earth, the next step will be signaling to other planets." Before the inventor could undertake such an enormous task, he first had to perfect wireless effects over long distances on the Earth. One of his plans was to send messages from his laboratory to receiving equipment which he was going to place on a Hudson River steamboat. Unfortunately, on March the 13th, 1895, Tesla's laboratory burned to the ground. The whole floor collapsed and equipment dropped to the second floor. For one fleeting moment, the civilized world was in shock, for the demolition of the maestro's atelier was a tragedy of incalculable proportions. Fortunately, Tesla was not injured, for he was asleep in his hotel at the time. Two tottering brick walls and the yawning jaws of a somber cavity aswim with black water and oil were all that could be seen that fateful morning, of a laboratory which to all who had visited it was one of the most interesting spots on Earth. This coming great man, current literature noted, who lives his life as in a dream, forgetful of the lapse of time and living only for the future, was about to revolutionize the cost and economies of electric lighting and place it within the reach of the humblest and poorest of people, to have all of his innumerable marvels swept away at one stroke is a calamity to the whole world as well as to himself. Perhaps, in part to help cheer Tesla up, and in honor of the Serbian-American pioneer of electrical communication, the Postal Telegraph Union of Serbia caused a sensation by connecting a simultaneous concert in Belgrade and Niš by telephone, so that both audiences could hear it. The Tesla laboratory was, in a sense, a private museum, T.C. Martin wrote. The owner kept in it many souvenirs of bygone toil and experiment. After describing in detail its contents, Martin concluded, "Perhaps the most painful loss of all is the destruction of Mr. Tesla's notes and papers. His memory is all right, and flashes on any experiment of the past with the revealing power of a searchlight, but the time it will take for the inventor to recreate his ongoing investigations will also cost other experimenters years of sweat and pain. Nevertheless, while the ashes of his hopes lay hot, Tesla was at work again with clenched determination." The strain was enormous, and Tesla steeled himself to fight off depression. One paper reported that he suffered a physical collapse. To help keep his spirits up, Martin met with the inventor at a local cafe to give him more free copies of their book. He may have also given him money. "Here it please your majesty," the editor said with a bow. "Your experiments have been repeated in Berlin under your name with the emperor's brother, Prince Henry, assisting. If you did not get a daily bolster from me, you would have a relapse into dullness, as you do when you miss your daily dose of electricity." The duo sat down to review Martin's article on the burning of the lab, so that a more accurate description of its lost contents could be enumerated. Westinghouse was still in the midst of battling William Stanley of the William Stanley Company and Elihu Thompson of GE in patent litigation, as each was continuing to produce AC induction motors illegally, while at the same time implying that the invention was of their own design. Together, these two concerns outsold Westinghouse by 10,000 kilowatts for the period 1893-97. According to some, their motors and generators were more efficient. Stanley, who continued to brazenly promulgate the sale of his polyphase system in advertisements in the electrical journals, had by this time increased his operation from 15 men to a few hundred, and GE was more than twice that size. Embroiled in the numerous patent disputes, the Westinghouse Company decided to take out a full-page advertisement, which proclaimed, "Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company, sole owners of the Tesla polyphase system." The display continued, "The novelty of Mr. Tesla's inventions was recognized by Professor Elihu Thompson, who said in discussing the Tesla inventions before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers in 1888, I have certainly been very much interested in the description given by Mr. Tesla of his new and admirable little motor. I have, as probably you may be aware, worked in somewhat similar directions and towards similar ends. The trials which I have made have been by the use of a single alternating current circuit, not a double alternating circuit." Although GE intimated that the Tesla motor was dangerous because it gave off too many sparks, there is no evidence that the fire in Tesla's lab was caused by his equipment. It had started in the floor below, in a dry cleaning establishment. Some investigators intimated that a careless night watchman may have been responsible, perhaps by smoking near oily rags. Estimates of the uninsured loss ranged as high as $1 million, but the actual damage was probably closer to $250,000. O'Neill suggests that Adams came to the rescue by advancing $40,000 in return for a piece of the company. However, Adams was already a partner, and thus he, Tesla, and the other partners all suffered losses. Still, there is some evidence that Adams did provide further assistance at this time. Royalties from Europe and continuing modest annual payments from the Westinghouse Company helped offset the misfortune, but clearly Tesla now needed to raise additional revenue in order to open up a new place. In particular, Tesla received a number of letters from friendly members of the Westinghouse Company. Ernest Heinrich, an engineer and author, wrote, "I hasten to offer you my sincere regret." Not knowing the situation, he continued, "I trust that you were well insured and will be able very soon to find another suitable location to carry on your work." Tesla was uninsured, but he had generated too much momentum to slow his progress. Within a few days, he was out scouting new locations. In the interim, he turned to the one lab where he knew vital equipment would be on hand. For the next few weeks, Nikola Tesla rolled up his sleeves at Tom Edison's workshop at Llewellyn Park, New Jersey, a laboratory that shuts out everybody who has not been given a pass by Mr. Edison himself or one of his assistants. Simultaneously, he contacted Albert Schmidt for more equipment, scoffing, as was his nature, at any expense which might be incurred. "I shall rely as to the price entirely on the fairness of the Westinghouse Company," Tesla said, concluding, "I believe that there are gentlemen in that company who believe in a hereafter." Vice President and General Manager Samuel Bannister shipped as a gift some early Tesla models which had been saved from the World's Fair, and wrote of his regret concerning "your misfortune. I am glad to know that you took off your coat to work to get everything back into shape as soon as possible." However, this was little consolation, as the Westinghouse Company would begin to bill Tesla for the cost of machinery lost in the fire, which was on loan. They also charged him for new equipment. In April, partly in response to Brisbane's announcement that Tesla was greater even than Edison, the rivalry between the two men, at least in the press, intensified. "Who is king, Edison or Tesla?" the Troy Press of New York inquired. Joseph Jefferson, speaking in Boston, left no doubt about his position. "Edison has been deposed," the thespian proclaimed, "and Tesla has been coronated new potentate." The twin wizards of electricity met in May in Philadelphia, along with Alexander Graham Bell, at the National Electrical Exposition. For the first time ever, Tesla's AC was transmitted the grand distance of 500 miles. Dassler was disappointed that no appreciable amount of power was transported along the existing telephone lines for fear, by the underwriters, that damage or a fire could result. Nevertheless, the experiment was a complete success and dwarfed the achievements of the old 100-mile Laufen-Frankfurt record.
"The most amazing thing at this exposition," Edison remarked, "is the demonstration of the ability to deliver here an electric current generated at Niagara Falls. To my mind, it solves one of the most important questions associated with electrical development."
Bell concurred, stating, "This long-distance transmission of electric power was the most important discovery of electric science that had been made for many years." Bell, with Edison looking into the future, realized that by means of this discovery, cities and towns remote from the places of electrical generation would be able to obtain the services of this agent, with great economy, and with a practical convenience far superior than is now possible. Tesla, who solved the problem, stated, "I am now convinced beyond any question that it is possible to transmit electricity by water power to commercial advantage over a distance of 500 miles at half the cost of generation by steam or coal. I am willing to stake my reputation and my life upon this declaration." No record exists of what was said between Tesla and Edison on this occasion, but it seems likely that each was privately amused by the rivalry played out in the press, that Tesla thanked Edison for the temporary use of his laboratory, and that Edison expressed his condolences for the loss of Tesla's workplace. GE was now losing the propaganda campaign on all fronts. Even Edison was admitting Tesla's accomplishment. Rumors began to circulate that an agreement with Westinghouse was reached on the pooling of patents, but a total solution was a number of years away, partly because GE had so many divisions that were pirating the apparatus, and partly because Westinghouse saw no immediate advantage in making a deal. After one significant loss in the courts, the headquarters of GE were forced to abandon its position, but they would continue to bargain because their financiers controlled the Niagara enterprise. Moreover, the size of that venture prevented Westinghouse from tackling it alone. T.C. Martin, however, naively thought that a complete reconciliation and vindication for Tesla was at hand.
"This would now mean the acknowledgement of supremacy of your polyphase patents," he wrote. "I suppose each will license the other."
It does not appear that Tesla enlightened him on the finality of the deal he had signed, because one full year later, the editor discussed the subject again.
"I cannot tell you how pleased I am about the news of the recognition of your patents by GE Company, and I hasten to congratulate you. This ought to fill your pockets with your own money," Martin concluded.
At least from a historical perspective, vindication was at hand, for now it was accepted even by the opposition that Tesla's work alone was making possible the yoking into service of old Niagara herself. But the inventor would never reap any financial gains other than those he had already settled for.
"This discovery forms the basis," Review of Reviews announced, "of the Niagara Company's attempt to utilize that enormous power which for centuries has been running to waste, and thus to turn machinery in towns and cities so far away as Buffalo, 20 miles distant, and perhaps New York and Chicago." And then the magazine dropped the bombshell. "And it underlies the hardly less bold venture of the Westinghouse and Baldwin companies to drive a through railway express by electricity. It is not too much to say that the Tesla motor is behind all the large attempts at power transmission by electricity which are being made throughout the country, not only in the fields of manufacture and transportation, but also in mining, irrigation, and farming." August the 7th, 1895.
"My dear Mr. Westinghouse, I learn from the journals of your friendly agreement with the Baldwin Locomotive Works. The news of your consolidation has been an agreeable surprise. Such a splendid union of means and abilities cannot fail to be of interest to both parties concerned. Yours very truly, M. Tesla."
Tesla was in need of new capital. The Westinghouse Corporation was billing him for lost equipment and for new machines ordered, and yet they had just gained two gargantuan contracts in two entirely separate fields, both based on his creation.
Surely the corporation would overlook a few $1,000s owed, especially when it was Tesla's personality that played a key role in gathering such principals of the Niagara Company as Edward Dean Adams, John Jacob Astor, and William Birch Rankin into the fold. It also occurred to the inventor that use of his induction motor in an entirely novel field, such as railway transportation, was, in a sense, outside the original intent of their contract. Should not he also benefit from such a fortuitous turn of events? Tesla would continue, somewhat naively, to bring new potential clients to Pittsburgh, almost as if he were their private ambassador, but he would never receive additional compensation for the service.
17. Martian Fever, 1895-96.
If there are intelligent inhabitants of Mars or any other planet, it seems to me that we can do something to attract their attention. I have had this scheme under consideration for 5 or 6 years. Nikola Tesla. John Jacob Astor III graduated from Harvard University at the age of 22 in 1888. He was one of the wealthiest men on the planet, with assets in the neighborhood of $100 million. By comparison, J. Pierpont Morgan's wealth was perhaps $30 million. As a youth, Astor had been an inventor, having patented a bicycle brake and a pneumatic walkway, which won a prize at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Other inventions included a storage battery, an internal combustion engine, and a flying machine. During his college years, when he was known by the unfortunate nickname of Jackass, Astor, who now sported long tapered sideburns and a waxed moustache, had undertaken courses with the inimitable astronomy professor William Pickering. One of Astor's pet projects was to find a way to create rain by pumping warm, moist air from the Earth's surface into the upper atmosphere. But the U.S. Patent Office had turned him down. Thus, when Pickering mentioned that the seasons were due to the inclination of the Earth's axis off of the ecliptic, Astor became intrigued. If the Earth were not tilted away from the sun, Pickering suggested, it would probably have one uniform moderate climate, even at the extreme north and south latitudes. As part of the curriculum, Astor was introduced to the Harvard Observatory. There, along with such up-and-comers as Percival Lowell, brother of the president of the university, Astor could peer through the great telescope and view such wonders as the craters on the moon, the satellites of Jupiter, and Saturn's spectacular rings. In April 1890, Professor Pickering made headlines when he photographed what he said was a snowstorm on the planet Mars. He calculated that the area covered was almost equal to that of the United States. 2 years later, during a celebrated trip to Harvard's observatory in Arequipa, Peru, the bushily bearded professor announced another major discovery.
Lakes in great numbers on Mars.
The canals, Pickering proclaimed, have dark as well as bright regions. We also observed clouds and the melting of snows, and this confirmed Herschel's hypothesis that there was vegetation around the regions of water.
The idea of attempting to signal Martians, as they were then called, was a familiar ambition of the day, and Astor, like Tesla, was caught in the fancy of it. In 1894, Percival Lowell announced in Nature his description of the canals of Mars. At the same time, Astor, just 30 years old, completed a science fiction novel about space travel. Entitled A Journey in Other Worlds, his book offered a futuristic vision of what takes place one century into the future. A few months after publication in February 1895, the financier presented a copy to the great inventor. Although Tesla did not appear to be particularly impressed by the work, the inventor promised Astor to keep it as an interesting and pleasant memento of our acquaintance. Adorned with ethereal outer space illustrations by Dan Beard, Astor's tale begins in the year 2000 with a meeting at Delmonico's restaurant of the Terrestrial Axis Straightening Company, whose task it is to create fair weather throughout the planet. Astor envisions, for the close of the 20th century, a picture telephone, an airplane with the ability to fly to Europe in one day, an electric automobile, hidden phonographs by the police to record conversations of criminals, color photography, a rain-making device, the idea of colonizing the solar system, and the understanding that the Earth would appear like a crescent moon when seen from outer space. Perhaps Astor's most impressive prediction is the path that his spaceship, Callisto, takes on its journey to Jupiter. Astor hypothesizes that just as magnetism has a repelling force, gravity should as well. This energy, which he called apogee, is simply the opposite of gravity. By harnessing apogee, the astronauts in the story aim their ship first toward the Sun, then change their course to something like a tangent to the Earth, and receive their final right direction, back out toward Jupiter, in swinging near the Moon, to bring apogee into play. Exactly a century after this book appeared, NASA actually did send a spacecraft, named the Galileo, on a voyage along a remarkably similar trajectory, using Venus instead of the Moon as the pivot for the swing back out toward Jupiter. Whereas this modern trip will take a few years, Astor's weary travelers cover the distance in a matter of days. Jupiter is abundant with life. Flowers greet them by singing with the volume of a cathedral organ. The red spot, they find out, was caused by a forest changing color due to a cold snap. Armed, the astronauts are able to hunt down animals resembling mastodons, which they kill for food. Fortunately, they also have the wherewithal to hop back onto the Callisto so they can return to Earth. Fueled by a competitive spirit, the newspapers and magazines continued to promulgate the idea that Mars was inhabited by beings possibly more intelligent than we. As Tesla made headlines in the New York dailies and electrical journals for his bold prediction that he would signal the stars, and Astor made the bookstores with his space-traveling romance of the future, other luminaries were also capitalizing on the extraterrestrial fervor. In 1895, George Lathrop, son-in-law of novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne, had Earthlings battle warriors from the Red Planet on the pages of the New York Journal. Their weapons were disintegrating death rays invented by the Wizard of Menlo Park, Thomas Edison. The following year, George Du Maurier, grandfather of Daphne, wrote the novel The Martian, in which he describes telepathic winged beings that descend from no monkey but are able to adorn marble statues and irrigate the entire planet. And the year after, H.G. Wells gained notoriety with his serialized Persons magazine horror story War of the Worlds, in which ghastly octopus-like Martians storm Earth in their egg-shaped spaceships and take over. Although fictional, these stories were based on prognostications put forward by supposedly sober scientists. The major culprit was the French astronomer and psychic researcher Camille Flammarion. In Stories of Infinity, Lumen, History of a Comet in Infinity, published in 1873, Flammarion interviewed Lumen, a sagacious returning comet, on such topics as the speed of light, time travel, and life on other planets. Lumen:
"Ah, if you knew the organisms that vibrate on Jupiter or Uranus, you would know that some living beings can understand without eyes, ears, or smell. That there are other faculties of an unascertainable number in nature, essentially different than yours."
This idea, called the plurality of worlds hypothesis, is an antediluvian concept which, through the ages, has counted numerous scientists among its adherents. Early astronomers such as Kepler, Newton, Laplace, and Herschel took this position, along with such modern astrophysicists as Carl Sagan. Human beings, grasping the immensity of the cosmos, know that life is not necessarily unique to Earth. Roman and Greek mythology, which concerned the lives and responsibilities of specific deities and included a god for each of the known planets, probably served as a psychological template for astronomers' speculations and corresponding religious beliefs. Carl Jung has linked such mythological thinking to the belief in UFOs, the search for meaning, and the search for God. Identifying God with the unknowable, the unconscious, and the wisdom revealed in dream interpretation, Jung says that the myth arises through attempts by the conscious to understand the unconscious. Thus, the mysteries of outer space are connected with those of inner space. Primordial instincts, archetypes, would therefore be the mechanism evolved through attempts to explain celestial natural phenomena. Over time, these were transformed into the myths of our forefathers. This belief in ancient sky gods and extraterrestrial existence stems from a common motif, that is, that humans cannot be the highest beings in the cosmos, and furthermore, that there is a supreme creator. Because the idea strikes a deep chord, through the centuries numerous scientists, artists, and authors have been seized by this notion. In 1835, Richard Adams Locke of the New York Sun created a series of front-page articles on astronomer Sir John Herschel, discoverer of Uranus, and alleged discoverer of advanced life forms on the Moon. Locke's hoax, which spread around the world before it was exposed, was made possible by the fact that Herschel was in South Africa at the time and therefore out of contact with the press. Herschel's supposed discoveries of unicorn-like animals and winged humanoids were made via a marvelous and fictitious telescope that was 150 feet long and could magnify the heavens 42,000 times. 30 years later, Jules Verne journeyed his readers to the Moon, but by the late 1870s, the destination had shifted to Mars. The first attempt to create a map of Mars and delineate the features seen on it can be traced back to Bernard de Fontana and Christian Huygens in the mid-1600s. More detailed drawings were sketched by Herschel in 1830 and by numerous other scientists in the 1860s and 1870s, such as Camille Flammarion, and in the 1880s by Giovanni Schiaparelli, who named these channels canali. In two scientific treatises, The Plurality of Worlds and Mars and Its Inhabitants, Flammarion stated his belief that Mars not only housed life, but also intelligent beings. Dwarfed in stature, positioned next to his 15-foot-tall telescope, the bearded French astronomer described in detail the mountains, valleys, craters, lakes, and oceans of Mars in North American Review in 1896. "It is obvious," Flammarion concluded, "the world of Mars is vigorously alive." Perhaps unconsciously influenced by the 1835 New York Sun hoax or Du Maurier's story, Flammarion suggested that due to the lightness of the atmosphere, the inhabitants may have received the privilege of flight. May they not rather be like dragonflies fluttering in the air above the lakes and the canals? Whereas Flammarion only set out to describe the Martians, Tesla actually made plans to contact them. The most influential American proponent, however, was undoubtedly the erudite Percival Lowell, descendant of the famous Massachusetts Lowell family. Influenced by Flammarion, Lowell would capture the front page of the newspapers on many occasions with Mars Inhabited headlines. He would also come to author a number of scholarly accounts covered in such prestigious journals as Nature and Scientific American, all culminating in his weighty text, The Canals of Mars, disseminated by the distinguished Macmillan Publishing Company. Unlike the warlike humans of Earth, Martians dwelled in a coordinated world, Lowell speculated. They had outgrown their savage instincts and consciously practiced peace. These Martians were sagacious builders who conserved their precious water and learned to live in a civilized global society. Mars was an older and thus more experienced planet. Its people had lived through the technological revolution eons ago, so they had learned to harvest and cultivate their planet from a global perspective. With humanity at the dawn of a new technological society, it was comforting to think that we would not have to face this rapidly advancing condition alone. As one of a community of intelligent planets, we had neighbors to whom we could turn for guidance. By the late 1890s, Lowell had completed construction of his own gargantuan telescope at Flagstaff, Arizona, where it is still today one of the finest in the world. There he would report each new discovery, including the cataloging of galaxies, which at the time were called island universes. It's hard to overestimate Lowell's impact on contemporary thinking. For instance, the vegetation hypothesis was echoed by Wernher von Braun, Willy Ley, and P. Bonestell, who co-wrote in their 1956 text, The Exploration of Mars, "And this is the picture of Mars at mid-century, a small planet which three-fourths is cold desert, with the rest covered with a sort of plant life, most likely lichen.
Mars is not the dead planet, but neither can it be inhabited by the kind of intelligent beings that many people dreamed of in 1900. A society's beliefs determines its reality.